Hey, Matt.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going great. Sorry, as I'm saying that, I'm, like, turning my computer screen. I'm sure I'm making all the viewers ill. I realized I was sort of out of frame. How's it going?
Things are good. Things are good. Glad you could, I don't know, I guess I'm filling in for Bill.
You are filling in. I'm not going above and beyond here. You are, so kudos to you.
Filling in for Bill, who once again is on assignment.
Ah, do we know what his assignment is?
We don't. He just says he's on assignment. I think he's at the beach or something, probably. But he says assignment.
Excellent.
I don't ask questions. He's the senior member of our threesome. So I think it's kind of good though that you and I do this, because a lot of the action happening right now is on the Republican side.
Yes.
So I think we have a lot to talk about, and let's dive in. This is the Weekend Blog, so I want to start with the blogger Eric Erickson, of course the prominent conservative blogger at redstate.com, who wrote a piece this week that got a lot of attention. This is before the debate. And he says Mitt Romney is going to be the Republican nominee, and his general election campaign will be an utter disaster for conservatives as he takes the GOP down with him and burns up what it means to be a conservative in the process. And then later he added, I'm starting to think I need to walk back my rejection of John Huntsman, because I'm starting to think even he would be more faithful to the conservative, to his conservative convictions than Mitt Romney. You might remember Eric Erickson actually accused John Huntsman of being disloyal, not just to President Obama, but to America. So this is huge if he thinks that John Huntsman is maybe a better conservative than Mitt Romney. I got a lot of news, but what was your read on this?
Well, my read on it was I think that it's too much to say that, you know, by nominating Mitt Romney, this would suddenly mean the death of conservatism. I often go back to that, you know, a lot of the same folks that are criticizing him now are the very same folks that really liked him last time around when he was more positioned as the candidate of the right.
Opposed to John McCain, who they hated worse.
Right, right. So, I mean, I don't know if it's just a change in the alternatives, or if it's that, you know, interestingly enough, you know, I don't necessarily think that Romney has, you know, the biggest thing that people are criticizing Romney about, he has not flip-flopped on at all. Some people wanted him to flip-flop on his healthcare plan, and he hasn't. So, you know, I think, you know, this debate has been had before. You know, to what extent is RomneyCare actually, you know, to what extent does that disqualify him from being considered a conservative? I think it depends on what your definition of conservative is. I thought what was funny was immediately after Erickson posted this post, all of a sudden, the big statement that came out of it that everyone was tweeting about was, is this like a quasi-endorsement of Huntsman? Is Huntsman for real? And Erickson quickly then later tweeted, like, no, I think people are reading too much into my Huntsman walk back. I still don't like him.
I think...
And the post that stuck out to me in response to this, I thought Connor Friedersdorf had an interesting post. His take on this was that part of the reason why folks don't think thought Romney was conservative last time but don't think he's conservative this time isn't necessarily because his positions have changed between 2007 and now on a lot of things. I mean, there are, of course, some things where folks are finding some gray area, but that by and large, last time, he was much more focused on the pandering to the right, the speaking
right.
the language of the right, the throwing out the red meat and the doing of the things that emotionally get the right excited about you, whereas Romney's clearly not been as interested in that tactic this time around. Meanwhile, Huntsman, who has a very conservative record, he has sort of never been in the business of throwing the red meat out to the base. So Friedersdorf's whole post is, are we going to define someone's conservatism by what they've done policy-wise or by how they comport themselves in a race? And he sort of blames Eric Erickson then, because Friedersdorf's not a big Erickson fan, for creating a culture where throwing out red meat and signals that you are conservative is much more rewarded than actually having a conservative record. And he thinks that this was sort of born out of the George W. Bush era, where Bush, despite doing an awful lot of spending and doing things that are kind of anathema to conservatives, like No Child Left Behind, that these were things, as long as Bush was still throwing red meat out there every once in a while, that it was okay. the conservative movement is placing more emphasis on style than on substance, and that's why someone like a Huntsman isn't getting perhaps the attention that he deserves given his record.
Well, I think it's true that style trumps substance right now, and it's a certain type of style. It's you've got to be tough, and you've got to attack Obama, and that's the definition of conservative essentially. And it's kind of sad. I don't think it's fair at all to blame Eric Erickson for contributing to that, but I do think it's a bit of a sad commentary on the state of conservatism. What else in there? I do want to bring up Eric Erickson, because, you know, this is a blog-type question. Erickson, his type of rhetoric, which I think is interesting, I think there's a lot of hyperbole in there. Like, for example, everybody sort of misinterpreted, but everybody, if you read it at face value, of course you would have assumed that this was like a tacit endorsement of John Huntsman. I mean, I didn't necessarily take it to be that because I read Red State a lot and I sort of know Eric's shtick. And I don't mean that in a pejorative sense, but his style, which I think is over-the-top rhetoric. And, for example, when Eric Erickson, when he basically says Mitt Romney is going to be the guy, I don't think that is like if Chuck Todd said that. You know, Chuck Todd would be doing analysis and trying to make a prediction. I don't think Erickson is predicting, despite what he says, I don't think he's predicting Romney. I think he's sending a warning flare out. I think he's basically starting to sense that conservatives are coalescing around Romney, or at least accepting the fact that he might be as good as it gets, and that Erickson is... and predicting that Romney will be the nominee is actually trying to scare conservatives into waking up and rallying around an alternative. That's how I interpreted his statement. And it is interesting because it's not exactly what he said. I don't know how to put it. Let me throw it to you and see if you agree, and if you have any thoughts on this brand of like what I would call activist blogging.
I think that what this is intended to do is to, I think what Erickson is trying to stop is conservatives who, maybe Mitt Romney's not their first choice, but folks who are kind of going through the stages of grief and are now in the acceptance stage.
Right.
And they're saying, you know, Mitt Romney wasn't my guy, but first, my guy was Michelle Bachmann, and she failed to do anything intelligent in these debates, and so then I moved to Rick Perry, and he bombed out. And then I moved to Herman Cain, and he has this scandal. And so I am feeling lost and feeling like I am trying to make my peace here. And so I think what the point of this post is to shock people.
Yeah.
And to say, no, the stakes here are not just, you know, we need to try to beat Obama and he's perhaps our best guy, which is why in his post he sort of walks through a case for why even if Romney is the nominee, he doesn't think that he will beat Obama. So he's saying, take that off the table. Like, stop thinking about that.
Well, let me ask you this.
Romney,
do you
realize there is a longer term threat that he poses besides just maybe losing to Obama?
Do you think
I disagree with that case, but I think that that's why he goes, I think that's part of the activism of this post, is that he's trying to shake folks out of any sort of settling that they might be in the process of doing while all these other candidates these last few weeks have started to implode.
And the way this is written is very in your face. Do you think that it's because he really wants to shake conservatives and warn them that Romney is winning, or do you think this is partly self-promotion? How much of this is about getting his name out there versus getting a message across? Any sense there?
I don't know. I mean, he's got a very big platform. He's got a contract with CNN. I mean, this is sort of, you know, being the guy with the defining post on what the conservative movement thinks about something is kind of his shtick. So, I mean, I don't know if this necessarily is intended as like, let's write a post that people who don't currently know who Eric Erickson is will have come across their radar and will go, ah, now I know who Eric Erickson is. Instead, I really think that in a way, I wonder if Romney wins the nomination against, you know, the sort of angry fury of conservative bloggers who dislike Romney, does this make the conservative blogosphere look like it actually doesn't have that much power? Like the establishment is right, that most Republicans are not where the bloggers are, that the bloggers are less powerful, that they're louder than they are powerful. I think that that's why you would have a blogger trying to shake people up to make the case, if we don't win this thing, then we lose. And I think that that's why he's saying conservatism dies. Now,
last time, though, last time, and you mentioned Erickson, Erickson, I think, at the end, probably jumped on the Romney bandwagon, but there were a lot of pro-Romney bloggers, like Catherine Lopez at National Review, Hugh Hewitt at Town Hall, Dean Barnett at Town Hall. I mean, there were a lot of pro-Romney bloggers, and I suspect, Hugh and Catherine Lopez are still blogging. I suspect that they're still very pro-Romney. So I don't even know if it would be fair to conclude that just because Erickson and a lot of other conservative bloggers are anti-Romney that the blogosphere loses if he wins.
I absolutely agree with you, but I think the point that he's trying to make and why he uses these big statements like conservatism will die,
right,
is because he's trying to make the point like my flavor of conservatism will die, and I believe that I'm right, and these other folks are milquetoast moderates masquerading as conservatives, or they don't have their priorities straight, or they read Jennifer Rubin and agree with her. You know, I don't know, but I think that that's why he uses the big language, is to say, like, this is about the place of bloggers like me who are trying to hold the movement accountable and trying to make sure that this party doesn't drift too far to the left and are trying... he's not really worried about the health and welfare of the Republican Party, and he says that repeatedly, but I think that if Romney becomes the nominee, then those bloggers that stood up very loudly and said, how can conservatives accept this guy? Do they wind up looking like a fringe instead of where... I mean, with the whole Tea Party emergence, folks were saying, you know, has the center of gravity in the Republican Party shifted to the Tea Party, to the conservative bloggers? With Rick Perry announcing his campaign at a blogger convention,
right?
I mean, it sort of implies, like, even candidates are trying to figure out, you know, is the blog community politically impactful?
I don't think that got enough...
A post by Eric Erickson influencing voters in Iowa.
I don't think that got enough play. You're right. I mean, Perry announced at a blogger conference, and I don't think that got enough play. It should be huge. It's a huge deal for bloggers. I don't think it got enough play. Hey, you mentioned Jennifer Rubin. Have you and Bill, because she's, Ben Smith at Politico wrote a big piece about her the other week.
Yeah, we did all, that was our...
Okay, so you guys did talk about her, because I think that's interesting. Well, let me segue then. I know you've got some info on Newt. Jennifer Rubin, I guess, is not a big Newt fan either. And at the debate Wednesday night, Gingrich was asked by John Harwood about lobbying for Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, and apparently Gingrich is like, no, I never did that. I gave him advice I didn't take. And Rubin has posted that transcript, and then sort of mocking, the parsing of what a lobbyist is versus a historian who's advising them. So we'll see. I don't know. Maybe if Perry's been fully dispatched, I don't think he has, but maybe if Perry's totally done, Rubin will turn her attention on Newt Gingrich next.
Well, as far as the Newt thing goes, there was a post by Rich Lowry that went up on Wednesday called Why Not Newt? And he starts with, I know, there are many reasons. but I understand why he's getting a second look and popping up in the polls. And he goes through and sort of says, he doesn't have the executive experience of Perry, he's not as likable as Kane, but he knows more and is better explaining what he believes. It's easier to imagine electing a former Speaker of the House president than someone who is head of a trade association. If the dynamic of the race is set up inevitably as Romney versus not Romney, Newt may have better odds than anyone else to be the not Romney. And I think in general, and this is a theme I've seen bloggers and, you know, I mean, if you look at Twitter during any debate, it's this constant chorus of, hey, Newt's doing really well. It's too bad. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But generally, I mean, Newt's kind of saying, in many cases, he's saying all the right things. But does he just come with too much baggage? And at a certain point, I mean, I really think there's the belief is that there will be Romney and then there will be the not Romney. Eventually people are going to come in fourth in Iowa and realize it is just time to fold.
Right.
And when they do, you know, who does that all coalesce around? I don't know if it becomes a Newt versus Romney race. I don't know how that turns out. But I do think it's interesting that that as everybody has fallen out, it's now Newt's turn in the musical chairs for who gets to be the not Romney.
Right.
Do you think Santorum's turn is 2 weeks from now?
Maybe. This, by the way, I mean, this is playing out in the blogosphere, too. I mean, Michelle Malkin a few months ago was like targeting Rick Perry over Gardasil and immigration. She's now turned her sights on Newt Gingrich.
Mm-hmm.
And she's got a post up today, of course, with a picture of Newt and Nancy Pelosi sitting on a couch talking about climate change. I mean, that's the problem, is that sort of baggage. I mean, once Newt becomes a viable enemy, someone who could threaten Mitt Romney, then all of a sudden, it's just he's got so much baggage, and including the ads he did with like Al Sharpton or whatever, or Newt Gingrich about climate change, or not with Nancy Pelosi. I will say I did interview emailed with is a better way of putting it, an email interview with Craig Shirley today, the Reagan biographer, and he's writing a book called Citizen Newt, which is set to come out right before the Iowa caucuses. And he told me we are witnessing one of the greatest comebacks in American history, speaking of Newt.
Mm.
So he is bullish about Newt. So there are clearly people who are believers, and there are people who are not. So
I want to give a full disclosure. The firm I work for, a pollster, David Winston, and he was Newt's director of planning in the late 90s and is a close buddy of Newt's, so I am not personally involved in anything in Newt world, but I just want to give that full disclosure as well to the viewers that you know, much as I like to think I'm impartial on this one, I don't think that Newt personally for me, he's not really my candidate in this race. It's kind of interesting having seen, I think one of the tweets that went out yesterday, this might have actually been Chuck Todd, I might be remembering this wrong, but they tweeted that it's kind of ironic that, you know, Newt staff left to go to Perry.
Yeah.
Now, if you're working for Perry, you're probably looking at Newt right now like, that would be the more attractive jump to make at this point.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it's what's been funny is that, you know, Romney has stayed in the front, in the bright lights, and people still haven't really landed a glove on him. While all of these other folks,
right,
as they rise up, all of a sudden the bloggers kind of turn and aim and fire, and then that person falls down.
Well, speaking of someone...
Romney's been able to survive it despite the repeated choruses throughout the blogosphere of, like, how is this happening?
And speaking of someone who has been under fire, we don't have to talk about Herman Cain's sexual harassment allegations, but part and parcel of that has been this movement on the blogosphere to get him to fire Mark Block, the smoking chief of staff. Michelle Malkin has a post up called Herman Cain's Worst Enemy. Eric Erickson today, on the Red State, calling on Herman Cain to, fire his team. He says last week J.D. Gordon, this is a communications guy for Cain, had a disastrous performance on a BlackBerry on Geraldo's show. His performance set the tone for Money News, all of which pointed out that your own communications vice president would not deny the story. We know that Mark Block, of course, at one point accused Rick Perry's team of being behind the allegation leak to Politico. Then he later sort of walked that back. Mark Block then accused said that Josh Krauschauer, who used to work at Politico, was related to Karen Krauschauer, one of the accusers. It turns out Krauschauer doesn't even work at Politico anymore, hasn't for a couple years, and isn't related in any way to the accuser. And he went on national television and said this. I think Ed Morrissey at Hot Air has voiced a similar statement. I had a post up at the Daily Caller yesterday where I interviewed some strategists, including Chris LaCivita, a top Republican strategist, who said essentially that this is amateur hour, that Herman Cain deserves better. So one of the interesting things on the blogosphere is essentially, you know, conservative bloggers have called on Herman Cain to oust Mark Block. Hasn't worked. And he says he's not gonna, by the way.
I think one of the things that, what you saw as troubling, or what Eric Erickson in his post saw as troubling, is that, you know, for Herman Cain, his appeal was never that he's, like, the smartest guy in the room and has all the solutions, but he tried to make the case, well, I'll surround myself with people
right.
who can handle this. Like, his economic advisor, Rich Lowry, who is not the same Rich Lowry as the one at National Review.
Nor is he an economist.
Yeah. So by having all of the people around him sort of crash and burn, I mean, it really sucks the life out of that argument
yeah.
of, I know how to put good people.
Right, and because Cain often deferred saying, like, well, I'm not going to talk about what I'm going to do in Afghanistan. I will listen to the experts. Well, you know, or he would say, like, as a businessman, I bring the best people in. Well, it doesn't really seem to be true. And Herman Cain may very well be entirely innocent of all these allegations, but he is clearly running a bad campaign. Unconventional doesn't have to be a code word for amateur. But it has been. And it is interesting that these conservative bloggers are essentially staging an intervention, a public intervention, saying you've got to have a better team, you've got to bring in some better people. I think Herman Cain should have had a female, a well-spoken, you know, polished female spokesperson during this scandal might have come in handy.
Well, I think he used to have a female communications director, and she's now just taken a job on the Hill.
Ellen Carmichael.
Yeah, yeah. So he probably could have used her help at this point. But what's actually been interesting, and maybe I have just not come across this, and maybe you have, is I was thinking because that you know there's this you know a lot of folks out there who really like Herman Cain, that when these women made these allegations, that there would wind up being sort of a blogosphere witch hunt to, like, really go after these women to figure out who they were and to tear them apart. And instead, I mean, I haven't really seen conservative bloggers trying to, like, disprove the allegations against a hero. Instead, it's actually been the mainstream media that I think has been brutalizing these women. You saw, like, Andrea Peiser, I guess, at the Washington Post, the New York Post, had, like, a really scathing column about Sharon, I'm going to pronounce it.
Bialik?
You know, I mean, so these women are really under a lot of fire, whether it's the one woman being say, oh, well, she's you know, basically going bankrupt and she's just doing this for money and attention. Coming out with Gloria Allred doesn't really help.
Right. And Cain also, though, and I thought it was a very risky strategy. It turns out, I don't think it hurt him, but he put out an email the day of his press conference, basically pointing out all you know all of her bankruptcies and law. She was a defendant in lawsuits and a paternity suit, and she had 9 jobs in 17 years, which actually isn't that many in today's world. He really went after her and tried to discredit her, and I thought he should have leaked it to me or a blogger or a reporter, Politico,
yeah.
whatever. I mean. If, you know, what could have happened is Cain's oppo people give it to, let's say, National Review. They write it, vet it, write it, and then the story goes out. Cain's fingerprints are clean, and yet his people can say, look, stuff's already coming out about her. I just saw, what was it, National Review posted. I mean,
that's how these things work.
Right,
that's
I don't
how
understand.
This whole deal works.
Why do you want to be, like, he didn't have to be a part of it. He could have totally separated himself from the negative side of, like, dishing information on this woman. It turned out it didn't hurt him because the rules don't apply anymore. But thank God for him they don't, because this could have really backfired on him. And it did.
I think at this point, though, I mean, if you really like Herman Cain and you're sticking with him through this whole story, then the allegations about the women are you know, that they just have made false accusations and bringing up all this credibility stuff about them isn't really changing your mind. On the other hand, if you were looking at Herman Cain and you were like, man, I liked you, but ugh, I don't know about these allegations, I don't know if this is really changing your mind. I think what's important is there's got to be like a middle group of people who are the sorts of like bloggers who are sympathetic to Herman Cain, but on the other hand, are frustrated with his handling of this story.
Oh, I think that is a huge contingent of conservatives and bloggers.
Yes, I think that's like the most critical chunk. And I think even though, like for instance, what you just described, him coming out and saying, "Oh, I've got all these facts about the women."
Right.
I mean,
in a sense a disqualifier as well. It's not just is he innocent. It's is this someone who can run a professional campaign, who can go toe-to-toe with Barack Obama and run a professional organization? And when, you know, in the big leagues, and that's probably, the answer to that is probably no.
And it's not even as though, one of the arguments that I've heard from a friend of mine who's a big Cain supporter is, you know, look, in 2004, when he ran for Senate, he had the benefit of having a Kurt Anderson on his staff.
Right.
This time around, anybody who's a big fish and who's a real professional and knows what they're doing didn't go work for Herman Cain. They went to go work for someone else because someone else had a chance and Herman Cain didn't. So with Herman Cain kind of scraping the bottom of the staff barrel, you know, how could he be expected to have a professional operation? But I don't think that's a good excuse. I think if you're smart, you don't need – I mean, I think having experienced staff is fine, but it's not as though I don't know, you know, 30 different people who all could probably competently run a presidential race.
And that's why
I'm currently working for someone.
Yeah, and that's why I reject that. I think you're totally right. I disagree with that premise because there are so many competent people out there, and you can always bring them in later like Rick Perry did. I mean, Rick Perry went out and brought in some people. You know, Cain could have done that. He could have, you know, campaigns grow, they evolve. He could have, you know, filtered out people, filtered in some more competent people. But there are so many quality people. I think it might be part of the ethos out there, which is to say, I'm going to run an unconventional campaign, and that means I'm not going to listen to any of these so-called experts because they're doing it the old way. I think that might be part of it, that mm-hmm. it being experienced and knowledgeable is in some way a minus. But my argument would be Herman Cain is unconventional enough for everybody. Like, he doesn't need he's an inexperienced candidate. He doesn't need an inexperienced manager too.
Yeah.
Why not have some teamwork? Let's couple an unconventional candidate with someone who knows what they're doing. And I'm reminded of Ed Rollins in the book Bare Knuckles in Back Rooms, where he says to Ross Perot, "I'm not trying to run a conventional campaign. I'm just trying to run a campaign." And I think sometimes that's the thing. It's like it would be nice, you know, there is such a thing as the wise old men and women that that sometimes can be a Sherpa.
Well, there's also common sense, too, that at a certain point, the way I think I've described this whole story is it's like one of those nuclear missiles that was developed in the Cold War to try to, for the U.S. and Russia to try to, like, get around the nuclear limitations. They call them MIRVs. It's like a nuke with like a bunch of different warheads on it, and so it launches, and it just seems like it's one missile, but then it separates and it becomes lots of different really bad nuclear warheads, doing lots more damage than one would have done on its own. And I feel like this story became that because common sense wasn't applied at the beginning.
No, I agree. They could have tamped this down. They could have come out. I mean, what they should have done, obviously, is bring this out themselves. I mean, Cain knew that he had these two settlements. We know he knows because he had approached Kurt Anderson in 2003 and said this could be a problem on my Senate race. Why didn't Cain come to me or any number, John McCormick or Philip Klein, anybody? I mean, and you know, 6 months ago, and tell the story, pick the timing, pick the reporter, frame it your way. That's what you do on a campaign. He could have given a speech about tort reform and talked about frivolous lawsuits and worked in it. You know, and I've even been a victim of this myself. You know, he could have brought it up and found a way, and then it could have been old news. Like, when Politico comes to him, he's like, "What? I've been up front about this. This was reported 6 months ago. Why are you guys rehashing old news?"
And the problem with a specific thing, allegations like this, is it would nearly be impossible for Herman Cain to prove his innocence. You can't prove your innocence in something like this. So your goal is not to prove that you're innocent by just denying it constantly and badly. I mean, you do deny it if you didn't do it, but then the story is now no longer, did Herman Cain do this or not do this? The story is, why does Herman Cain have a weird spokesman who goes and lies on TV all the time?
And by
why
the way, the spokesman...
Cain say that he didn't know about a settlement, and then he did know about a settlement.
And all those things, the back and forth, and then the parsing, is it a settlement or an agreement? And then the smoking video, and his spokesman actually, interestingly, sued a reporter for sexual harassment. I mean, there's all these subplots that are so weird. But here's the thing. I wonder if he may have weathered the storm. The debate Wednesday night with Rick Perry, I don't know if we're in the eye of the hurricane or if Herman Cain has weathered the storm, but I think there's a chance that it's over and that he survives this. What do you think?
Well, I think, like, the point that you made earlier, though, about how as soon as Newt became the guy, all of a sudden Michelle Malkin turned her fire on him.
Right,
you know, when Perry was the guy, Michelle Malkin turned her fire on him. I think that, you know, Herman Cain was the guy, and then I think after this, maybe there's a sense that he's just toast.
Well,
and because there's no salvaging this, but that it seems as though at every step of the way since these allegations, he's made the wrong moves.
Yeah.
So there's no way that he's going to make it and be viable through Iowa, so people just aren't paying.
And there is a theory, there is an interesting theory that he doesn't start losing support until the scandal goes away. I don't know who came up with this theory, but it's interesting. Which is to say that as long as Herman Cain is being attacked, he is not seen as a candidate, he is seen as a cultural icon that conservatives must protect. And so they will rally to his defense. But the theory is that once time passes and the storm passes, he just starts shedding support because his honor will have been defended, but no one really thinks he should be president anymore.
I've always wondered if his support even was going to naturally begin to decline, that... you know, you can run on a 999 and get people really pumped about it for a period of time, but eventually, I mean, the host of blog posts that I've talked about on the show over the last month or so, all sort of like picking at 999 and saying, here's all the problems with it, eventually that kind of takes its toll, and so what's Herman Cain's next act? What, like, he can only say 999 so many times, and it didn't seem like Herman Cain had a substantive next act that he was ready to roll out.
Right.
So in a way, maybe this has bought him time because nobody's expecting him to be talking about jobs in the economy because everybody's, you know, this is the Herman Cain topic du jour at the moment. But I think, you know, whether the scandal happened or not, he needed to have a next chapter of some kind of substance to keep people in. And I didn't see any evidence of that happening. And I think eventually people were going to tire of him and it was going to be somebody's turn anyways to move up into the non-Romney spot.
So I know we're going to have an abbreviated TWIB this week. You want to cut it there, or do you want to talk Mitt Romney? I'll leave it up to you.
You know, I think the last thing that I was going to say is, you know, if we talked a little bit about Rick Perry. He's the story that I think is more interesting this week, given the outcome of the debates. There's Byron York had an interesting post this morning at the Examiner where he was talking about how, you know, is Perry done? Is, you know, if you were on Twitter last night, if you missed the debate, you could be forgiven for thinking that Perry actually just died up on stage.
The conventional wisdom on
the clip, and watching the clip is incredibly uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Anyways, but Rick Perry had this very bad moment where he kind of stumbled in isolation. Wouldn't have been so bad, but it fed a narrative that he's just not so bright, not into this. And Byron York's post was pretty interesting because he sort of runs through Rick Perry's schedule and all of the places that he's been, and has he been going to these early states. And it actually doesn't look like Perry has been, you know, going to 18 events a day, like you expect somebody to be. I mean, you expect somebody to be kissing every baby in the state of Iowa at this point in the game. And it looks like his schedule was a little more, like there were whole days when it, you know, there was kind of nothing. And he sort of makes the case that if Perry got talked into this race and wasn't fully prepared to run for president, it's a really lousy time to start crafting policy positions while you're supposed to be in kissing baby mode. That now is not the time in the race for you to be a student of public policy, that now is the time for you to be shaking hands and eating fried chicken out at, you know, at VFW halls. So I wonder, to what extent there you've seen any of this from other bloggers, that there's a frustration similar to the Herman Cain frustration. Like, Herman, we really like you. Why are you running a bad campaign? That same frustration being echoed for Perry. Hey, Perry, we like you. Why can't you just keep it together and do this the right way?
Yeah, I think it's really been surprising how the campaign has floundered. I think there was a big expectation that he would do well. I think everyone's surprised that debates have played the role that they've played. Normally, I don't think they're this important in primaries, and they seem to be the most important thing. It's like retail politics doesn't matter. Fundraising doesn't matter. It's all about debates and wholesale. And that defies everything we know about Iowa and New Hampshire. And maybe things get normal again. Maybe Iowa ends up being about organization and money and the debates don't matter. I don't know, when we get closer. But as of now, debates matter, and Rick Perry's a bad debater, and he's had bad debates, and he had a horrible debate Wednesday night. The conventional wisdom on Twitter, if you were on Twitter when that moment happened, everybody was pronouncing him dead. And I think that, now, let me say, it was a very, very bad moment for him. You're right that it feeds into a narrative people already think about him, and it's devastating. But I'm just not sure that it's the end for him. Like, I feel like the reports of his death are exaggerated.
Now I can't find the post. I had it up on my screen. I'm not supposed to have the internet browser open while we're doing this show.
I got like 10 up. I mean, they tell
me. Oh, okay, good.
Do it.
There's a post I saw. Oh, gosh,
Fight the Power.
I can't find this. It's by Drew, from Ace of Spades, but it's not posted to Ace of Spades, where he says like that now less than.
So you don't know who this is? You can't remember? You're saying that you can't remember who this is? I'm just playing John Harwood here. I think John Harwood. Here's the thing. I feel like Rick Perry like almost escaped, and then John Harwood was like. So, but is it really the EPA? You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. I felt bad for him because I've been on the show and I've done that many times. Like, there's a blogger. Shoot, I read a lot of bloggers today. It was Drew from Ace of Spades. That's it. So I felt bad for him. I think that what this post then said was that that thinking Rick Perry is dead is so done. So yesterday, today is now. This is actually the thing that is going to jumpstart Rick Perry, oddly enough, because he's doing this Letterman thing. He's going on The Daily Show, he's taking this sort of weird strategy of he's owning it. He's not stepping back. He's not saying I made a mistake. Let's move on. I'm gonna talk about jobs, which I think he probably should have said. I made a mistake. Now let's talk about jobs.
Right.
But if he's gonna go on and miscount things on David Letterman and just sort of eat it up and endear himself to the portion of the Republican primary electorate that doesn't care that he flubbed on stage. I mean, hey,
it's,
this could be an interesting strategy.
Right, and they're handling it about as well as you could possibly handle this. They're smart. They're being funny. And there is a post. What's Grace Weiler at Business Insider has a piece titled "Rick Perry's Collapse is the Best Thing That Could Have Happened to Him." So there is unconventional wisdom out there that this is somehow good for Rick Perry. I don't know that I would go quite that far either. I think I'm somewhere in the middle. It was very bad, but I don't know that it's the end of the world. So
what definitely changes the expectations game in that I think Perry can now survive coming in third in Iowa and keep the train on running, because people at this point, because he's doing so badly in the polls, because these debates aren't going so well.
The only thing I could say about that is Perry, it would have been better for Perry had he gotten in early, bottomed out early, and came back early. You know what I'm saying? Like in 2007, John McCain hit his nadir in June, and he had 6 months to make a comeback to New Hampshire. We're in November now.
Yeah.
Now, doesn't mean it can't be done. John Kerry in November of 2003, I think, was a laughingstock, as I recall. But it's not a lot of time to be hitting rock bottom. So,
Yeah, I don't know if, I mean, but he certainly has the money to come back.
Yeah.
And he's the only one that's up on the air in Iowa right now, I think, so.
Right. The problem, though, is he's up on the air, but he has to, because of his debate problems, he has to keep running positive ads. So
yeah.
he's really, the money is basically like treading water. It's keeping him alive, but it's not really advancing him. Is the problem.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, good talking to you as
good
always.
Good talking to you too, Matt.
We should do every once in a while do a Republican or a conservative right side of the blogosphere, the weekend blog. So
I like this. I like this because there's only so many times that I can berate Bill for Occupy Wall Street. So
that's right. That's right.
This was fun. Let's do it again sometime soon.
You got it. Have a good one, and we'll see you all back here next week on The Week in Blog. Ciao.